Random House Audio presents The Weed That Strings the Hangman's Bag, A Flavia Deluce Mystery, by Alan Bradley, read for you by Jane Entwistle. Sir Walter Raleigh to his son. Three things there be that prosper up apace, and flourish while they grow asunder far. But on a day they meet all in a place, and when they meet, they one another mar. And they be these, the wood, the weed, the wag. The wood is that that makes the gallows tree. The weed is that that strings the hangman's bag. The wag, my pretty knave, betokens thee. Now mark, dear boy, while these assemble not. Green springs the tree, hemp grows, the wag is wild. But when they meet, it makes the timber rot. It frets the halter, and it chokes the child. Chapter 1. I was lying dead in the churchyard. An hour had crept by since the mourners had said their last sad farewells. At 12 o'clock, just at the time we should otherwise have been sitting down to lunch, there had been the departure from Buckshaw. My polished rosewood coffin being brought out of the drawing-room, carried slowly down the broad stone steps to the driveway, and slid with heart-breaking ease into the open door of the waiting hearse, crushing beneath it a little bouquet of wildflowers that had been laid gently inside by one of the grieving villagers. Then there had been the long drive down the avenue of chestnuts to the Mulford gates, whose rampant griffins looked away as we passed, though whether in sadness or in apathy, I would never know. Dogger, father's devoted jack-of-all-trades, had paced in measured step alongside the slow hearse, his head bowed, his hand resting lightly on its roof, as if to shield my remains from something that only he could see. At the gates, one of the undertaker's mutes had finally coaxed him, by using hand signals, into a hired motor car. And so they had brought me to the village of Bishop's Lacey, passing somberly through the same green lanes and dusty hedgerows I had bicycled every day when I was alive. At the heaped-up churchyard of St. Tancred's, they had taken me gently from the hearse and borne me at a snail's pace up the path beneath the limes. Here they had put me down for a moment in the new-mown grass. Then had come the service at the gaping grave, and there had been a note of genuine grief in the voice of the vicar as he pronounced the traditional words. It was the first time I'd heard the order for the burial of the dead from this vantage point. We had attended last year, with father, the funeral of old Mr. Dean, the village greengrocer. His grave, in fact, was just a few yards from where I was presently lying. It had already caved in, leaving not much more than a rectangular depression in the grass that was, more often than not, filled with stagnant rainwater. My oldest sister, Ophelia, said it collapsed because Mr. Dean had been resurrected and was no longer bodily present, while Daphne, my other sister, said it was because he had plummeted through into an older grave whose occupant had disintegrated. I thought of the soup of bones below, the soup of which I was about to become just another ingredient. Flavia Sabina Deluce, 1939 to 1950. They would cause to be carved on my gravestone a modest and tasteful grey marble thing with no room for false sentiments. Pity. If I'd lived long enough, I'd have left written instructions calling for a touch of Wordsworth. A maid whom there were none to praise and very few to love. And if they'd balked at that, I'd have left this as my second choice. Truest hearts by deeds unkind, to despair are most inclined. Only Feely, who had played and sung them at the piano, would recognise the lines from Thomas Campion's Third Book of Airs, and she would be too consumed by guilty grief to tell anyone. My thoughts were interrupted by the vicar's voice. Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, in sure and certain hope of the resurrection to eternal life, through our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall change our vile body." And suddenly they had gone, leaving me there alone, alone to listen for the worms. This was it, the end of the road for poor Flavia. By now, the family would already be back at Buckshaw, gathered round the long refectory table, Father seated in his usual stony silence, Daffy and Feely hugging one another with slack, tear-stained faces as Mrs. Mullet, our cook, brought in a platter of baked meats. I remembered something that Daffy had once told me when she was devouring The Odyssey, that baked meats, in ancient Greece, were traditional funeral fare, and I had replied that, in view of Mrs. Mullet's cooking, not much had changed in 2,500 years. But now that I was dead, I thought, perhaps I ought to practice being somewhat more charitable. Dogger, of course, would be inconsolable. Dear Dogger, butler come chauffeur, come valet, come gardener, come estate manager. A poor, shell-shocked soul whose capabilities ebbed and flowed like the Severn tides. Dogger, who had recently saved my life and forgotten it by the next morning. I should miss him terribly. And I should miss my chemistry laboratory. I thought of all the golden hours I'd spent there in that abandoned wing of Buckshaw, blissfully alone among the flasks, the retorts, and the cheerily bubbling tubes and beakers. And to think that I'd never see them again. It was almost too much to bear. I listened to the rising wind as it whispered overhead in the branches of the yew trees. It was already growing cool here in the shadows of St. Tancred's Tower, and it would soon be dark. Poor Flavia. Poor stone-cold, dead Flavia. By now, Daffy and Feely would be wishing that they hadn't been so downright rotten to their little sister during her brief 11 years on this earth. At the thought, a tear started down my cheek. Would Harriet be waiting to welcome me to heaven? Harriet was my mother, who had died in a mountaineering accident a year after I was born. Would she recognize me after 10 years? Would she still be dressed in the mountain-climbing suit she was wearing when she met her end? Or would she have swapped it by now for a white robe? Well, whatever she was wearing, I knew it would be stylish. There was a sudden clatter of wings, a noise that echoed loudly from the stone wall of the church, amplified to an alarming volume by a half-acre of stained glass and the leaning gravestones that hemmed me in. I froze. Could it be an angel, or more likely an archangel, coming down to return Flavia's precious soul to paradise? If I opened my eyes the merest slit, I could see through my eyelashes, but only dimly. No such luck. It was one of the tattered jackdaws that were always hanging around St. Tancred's. These vagabonds had been nesting in the tower since its 13th-century stonemasons had packed up their tools and departed. Now the idiotic bird had landed clumsily on top of a marble finger that pointed to heaven and was regarding me coolly, its head cocked to one side with its bright, ridiculous boot-button eyes. Jackdaws never learn. No matter how many times I played this trick, they always, sooner or later, came flapping down from the tower to investigate. To the primeval mind of a jackdaw, any body, horizontal in a churchyard, could have only one meaning. Food. As I had done 12 times before, I leapt to my feet and flung the stone that was concealed in my curled fingers. I missed, but then I nearly always did. With an awk of contempt, the thing sprang into the air and flapped off behind the church towards the river. Now that I was on my feet, I realized I was hungry. Of course I was. I hadn't eaten since breakfast. For a moment, I wondered vaguely if I might find a few leftover jam tarts or a bit of cake in the kitchen of the parish hall. The St. Tancred's Ladies' Auxiliary had gathered the night before, and there was always the chance. As I waded through the knee-high grass, I heard a peculiar snuffling sound. And for a moment, I thought the saucy jackdaw had come back to have the last word. I stopped and listened. Nothing. And then it came again. I find it sometimes a curse, and sometimes a blessing, that I have inherited Harriet's acute sense of hearing, since I am able, as I am fond of telling Feely, to hear things that would make your hair stand on end. One of the sounds to which I am particularly attuned is the sound of someone crying. It was coming from the northwest corner of the churchyard, from somewhere near the wooden shed in which the sexton kept his grave-digging tools. As I crept slowly forward on tiptoe, the sound grew louder. Someone was having a good old-fashioned cry of the knock-em-down, drag-em-out variety. It is a simple fact of nature that while most men can walk right past a weeping woman as if their eyes are blinkered and their ears stopped up with sand, no female can ever hear the sound of another in distress without rushing instantly to her aid. I peeped round a black marble column, and there she was, stretched out full length, face down on the slab of a limestone tomb, her red hair flowing out across the weathered inscription like rivulets of blood. Except for the cigarette wedged stylishly erect between her fingers, she might have been a painting by one of the pre-Raphaelites, such as Burne Jones. I almost hated to intrude. "Hello," I said. "Are you all right?" It is another simple fact of nature that one always begins such conversations with an utterly stupid remark. I was sorry the instant I'd uttered it. "Oh, of course I'm all right," she cried, leaping to her feet and wiping her eyes. "What do you mean by creeping up on me like that? Who are you anyway?" With a toss of her head, she flung back her hair and stuck out her chin. She had the high cheekbones and the dramatically triangular face of a silent cinema star, and I could see by the way she bared her teeth that she was terrified. "Flavia," I said. "My name is Flavia Deluce. I live near here, at Buckshaw." I jerked my thumb in the general direction. She was still staring at me like a woman in the grip of a nightmare. "I'm sorry," I said. "I didn't mean to startle you." She pulled herself up to her full height, which couldn't have been much more than 5 feet and an inch or two, and took a step towards me, like a hot-tempered version of the Botticelli Venus that I'd once seen on a Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin. I stood my ground, staring at her dress. It was a creamy cotton print with a gathered bodice and a flaring skirt, covered all over with a myriad of tiny flowers, red, yellow, blue, and a bright orange the colour of poppies, and, I couldn't help noticing, a hem that was stained with half-dried mud. "What's the matter?" she asked, taking an affected drag on her angled cigarette. "Never seen anyone famous before?" "Famous? I hadn't the faintest idea who she was. I had half a mind to tell her that I had indeed seen someone famous and that it was Winston Churchill. Father had pointed him out to me from a London taxicab. Churchill had been standing in front of the Savoy with his thumbs hooked in his waistcoat pockets, talking to a man in a yellow Macintosh." "Good old Winnie," Father had breathed as if to himself. "Oh, what's the use?" the woman said. "Bloody place, bloody people, bloody motor cars." And she began to cry again. "Is there something I can do to help?" I asked. "Oh, go away and leave me alone," she sobbed. "Very well, then," I thought. Actually, I thought more than that, but since I'm trying to be a better person. I stood there for a moment, leaning forward a bit to see if her fallen tears were reacting with the porous surface of the tombstone. Tears, I knew, were composed largely of water, sodium chloride, manganese, and potassium, while limestone was made up chiefly of calcite, which was soluble in sodium chloride, but only at high temperatures. So unless the temperature of St. Tancred's churchyard went up suddenly by several hundred degrees, it seemed unlikely that anything chemically interesting was going to be happening here. I turned and walked away. Flavia! I looked back. She was reaching out a hand to me. I'm sorry, she said. It's just that it's been a bloody awful day, all round. I stopped, then paced slowly, warily back as she wiped her eyes with the back of her hand. Rupert was in a foul mood to begin with, even before we left Stoke Moor this morning. We'd had rather a row, I'm afraid, and then the whole business with the van. It was simply the last straw. He's gone off to find someone to fix it. And I'm... well, here I am. I like your red hair, I said. She touched it instantly and smiled, as I somehow knew she would. Carrot Top, they used to call me when I was your age. Carrot Top. Fancy. Carrot Tops are green, I said. Who's Rupert? Who's Rupert? She asked. You're having me on. She pointed a finger and I turned to look. Parked in the lane at the corner of the churchyard was a dilapidated van, an Austin 8. On its side panel, in showy gold circus letters, still legible through a heavy coating of mud and dust, were the words, Pawson's Puppets. Rupert Pawson, she said. Everyone knows Rupert Pawson. Rupert Pawson, as in Snoddy the Squirrel, the Magic Kingdom. Haven't you seen him on the television? Snoddy the Squirrel? The Magic Kingdom? We don't have the television at Buckshaw, I said. Father says it's a filthy invention. Father is an uncommonly wise man, she said. Father is undoubtedly... She was interrupted by the metallic rattle of a loose chain guard as the vicar came wobbling round the corner of the church. He dismounted and leaned his battered rally up against a handy headstone. As he walked towards us, I reflected that Canon Denwin Richardson was not anyone's image of a typical village vicar. He was large and bluff and hearty, and if he'd had tattoos, he might have been mistaken for the captain of one of those rusty tramp steamers that drags itself wearily from one sun-drenched port to another in whatever god-awful outposts are still left of the British Empire. His black clerical outfit was smudged and streaked with chalky dust, as if he'd come a cropper on his bicycle. "Blast," he said when he spotted me. "I've lost my trouser clip and torn my cuff to ribbons." And then, dusting himself off as he walked towards us, he added, "Cynthia's going to have me on the carpet." The woman's eyes widened and she shot me a quick glance. "She's recently begun scratching my initials on my belongings with a needle," he went on, "but that hasn't kept me from losing things. Last week, the hectograph sheets for the parish bulletin. The week before, a brass doorknob from the vestry. Maddening, really." "Hello, Flavia," he said. "Always nice to see you at church."
"This is our vicar, Canon Richardson," I told the red-headed woman. "Perhaps he can help."
"Denwin," the vicar said, holding out a hand to the stranger. "We don't stand much on ceremony since the war."
The woman stuck out two or three fingers and touched his palm, but said nothing. As she extended her hand, the short sleeve of her dress slid up, and I had a quick glimpse of the ugly green and purple bruise on her upper arm. She covered it hastily with her left hand as she tugged the cotton fabric down to hide it.
"And how may I be of service?" the vicar asked, gesturing towards the van. "It is not often that we, in our bucolic little backwater, are called upon to minister to such august theatre folk."
She smiled gamely.
"Our van's broken down, or as good as. Something to do with the carburetor. If it had been anything electrical, I'm sure Rupert could have mended it in a flash, but I'm afraid the fuel system is beyond him." "Dear, dear," the vicar said. "I'm sure Bert Archer at the garage can put it right for you.
I'll ring him up, if you like.
Oh, no, the woman said quickly. Perhaps too quickly. We wouldn't want you to go to any trouble. Rupert's gone down the high street. He's probably already found someone.
If he had, he'd be back by now, the vicar said. Let me ring Bert. He often slips home for a nap in the afternoon. He's not as young as he was, you know.
Nor are any of us, if it comes to that.
Still, it is a favourite maxim of mine that, when dealing with motor mechanics, even tame ones, it never does one any harm to have the blessing of the church.
Oh, no, it's too much trouble. I'm sure we'll be just fine.
Nonsense, the vicar said, already moving off among the forest of gravestones and making at full speed for the rectory. No trouble at all. I'll be back in a jiffy.
Vicar, the woman called, please.
He stopped in mid-stride and came reluctantly back towards us.
It's just that, you see, we...
Aha, a question of money then, the vicar said.
She nodded sadly, her head down, her red hair cascading over her face.
I'm sure something can be arranged, the vicar said. Ah, here's your husband now.
A little man with an oversized head and a lopsided gait was stumping towards us across the churchyard, his right leg swinging out at each step in a wide, awkward semicircle. As he approached, I saw that his calf was caged in a heavy iron brace. He must have been in his 40s, but it was difficult to tell. In spite of his diminutive size, his barrel chest and powerful upper arms seemed ready to burst out of the seersucker suit that confined them. By contrast, his right leg was pitiful. By the way in which his trousers clung and flapped uselessly round what lay beneath, I could see that it was little more than a matchstick. With his huge head, he looked to me like nothing so much as a giant octopus stalking on uneven tentacles through the churchyard. He lurched to a halt and deferentially lifted a flat, peaked motoring cap, revealing an unruly mop of pale blonde hair that matched precisely his little Van Dyke goatee.
"Rupert Porson, I presume," the vicar said, giving the newcomer a jolly, hail-fellow-well-met handshake. "I'm Denwin Richardson, and this is my young friend, Flavia Deluce."
Porson nodded at me and shot an almost invisibly quick, dark glance at the woman before turning on the full beam of a searchlight smile.
"Spot of engine trouble, I understand," the vicar went on. "Quite maddening. Still, if it has brought the creator of the magic kingdom and Snoddy the Squirrel into our midst, well, it just proves the old adage, doesn't it?"
He didn't say which old adage he was referring to, nor did anyone care enough to ask.
"I was about to remark to your good wife," the vicar said, "that St. Tancred's would be honoured indeed if you might see your way clear to presenting a little entertainment in the parish hall whilst your van is being repaired. I realise, of course, how much in demand you must be, but I should be negligent if I didn't at least make the attempt on behalf of the children. And yes, the grown-ups, too, of Bishop's Lacey. It is good, now and then, to allow children to launch an attack upon their money boxes in a worthy cultural cause. Don't you agree?"
"Well, vicar," Porson said, in a honeyed voice, too big, too resonant, too mellifluous, I thought, for such a tiny man. "We do have rather a tight timetable. Our tour has been grueling, you see, and London calls."
"I understand," said the vicar.
"But,"
Porson added, lifting a dramatic forefinger,
"nothing would delight us more than being allowed to sing for our supper, as it were. Isn't that so, Nia? It shall be quite like the old days."
The woman nodded but said nothing. She was staring off at the hills beyond.
"Well, then," the vicar said, rubbing his hands together vigorously, as if he were making fire. "If it's all arranged, come along and I'll show you the hall. It's rather tatty, but it does boast a stage, and the acoustics are said to be quite remarkable."
With that, the two men disappeared round the back of the church.
For a moment there seemed nothing to say, and then the woman spoke.
You wouldn't happen to have a cigarette, would you? I'm dying for a smoke.
I gave my head a rather idiotic shake.
She said. You look like the kind of kid who might have.
For the first time in my life, I was speechless.
I don't smoke, I managed.
And why is that? She asked.
Too young or too wise?
I was thinking of taking it up next week, I said lamely. I just hadn't actually got round to it yet.
She threw her head back and laughed toothily, like a film star.
I like you, Flavia Deluce, she said. But I have the advantage, don't I? You've told me your name, but I haven't told you mine.
It's Nia, I said. Mr. Pawson called you Nia.
She stuck out her hand, her face grave.
That's right, she said. He did. But you can call me Mother Goose.
Chapter 2
Mother Goose?
I have never much cared for flippant remarks, especially when others make them, and in particular, I don't give a frog's fundament for them when they come from an adult.
It has been my experience that facetiousness in the mouth of someone old enough to know better is often no more than camouflage for something far, far worse. And yet, in spite of that, I found myself swallowing the sharp and deliciously nasty retort that was already on the tip of my tongue, and instead managed a diluted smile.
Mother Goose? I repeated dubiously.
She burst into tears again, and I was glad that I had held my tongue. I was about to be instantly rewarded by hearing something juicy. Besides, I had already begun to detect a slight but invisible attraction between this woman and myself. Could it be pity? Or was it fear? I couldn't say. I knew only that some deep-seated chemical substance inside one of us was crying out to its long-lost complement. Or was it its antidote, in the other? I put a hand gently on her shoulder and held out my handkerchief. She looked at it skeptically.
It's all right, I said. They're only grass stains.
That set her off into a remarkable contortion. She buried her face in the handkerchief, and her shoulders quaked so violently, I thought for a moment she was going to fly to pieces. To allow her time to recover, and because I was rather embarrassed by her outburst, I wandered off a little distance to examine the inscription on a tall, weathered gravestone that marked the grave of one Lydia Green, who had died in 1638 at the age of 135 years. She once wore green, but now she waxeth white, it said on the stone, lamented by a few friends. Had Lydia lived, I reflected, she would now be 447 years old, and probably a person well worth getting to know.
Oh, I feel such a chump.
I turned to see the woman dabbing at her eyes and giving me a damp grin.
I'm Nia, she said, sticking out a hand. Rupert's assistant.
I fought back my revulsion and gave her fingers a lightning-quick shake. As I had suspected, her hand was wet and sticky. As soon as I was decently able, I slid my own hand out of sight behind my back and wiped it on the back of my skirt.
Assistant? The word popped out of my mouth before I could stop it.
Oh, I know the vicar assumed that I'm Rupert's wife, but it's not like that. Honestly, it's not like that at all. I glanced over involuntarily at the Pawson's puppet's van. She spotted it at once.
Well, yes, we do travel together. I suppose Rupert and I have what you might call a very great affection for one another.
But husband and wife?
What kind of fool did she take me for? It was no more than a week since Daffy had been reading aloud to Feely and me from Oliver Twist, and I knew, as surely as I knew my own name, that this woman, Nia, was Nancy to Rupert Pawson's Bill Sykes. Didn't she realize that I'd spotted the filthy great bruise on her upper arm?
Actually, it's such jolly fun rattling about England with Rupert. He's recognized everywhere we go, you know. Just the day before yesterday, for instance, we were playing at Market Selby when we were spotted in the post office by a fat lady in a flower-pot hat.
"Rupert Pawson!" she shrieked. "Rupert Pawson uses the Royal Mail, just like everyone else!"
Nia laughed. And then she begged him for his autograph. Oh, they always do, you know. Insisted he put, "Best wishes from Snoddy the Squirrel." When he does it that way, he always draws a couple of little nuts. She claimed she wanted it for her nephew, but I knew better. When you're on the road a lot, you develop a certain sense for these things. You can always tell. She was prattling. If I kept quiet, it wouldn't be more than a minute before she would be confiding her size in knickers. Someone at the BBC told Rupert that 23% of his viewing audience is made up of childless housewives. Seems a lot, doesn't it? But there's something about the Magic Kingdom that satisfies one's innate desire for escape. That's the exact way they put it to Rupert. One's innate desire for escape. Everyone needs to escape, don't they? In one way or another, I mean. "Everyone but Mother Goose," I said. She laughed. "Look, I wasn't pulling your leg. I am Mother Goose. At least, I am when I put on my costume. Just wait until you see it. Tall witch's hat with a floppy brim and a silver buckle, a grey wig with dangling ringlets, and a great puffy dress that looks as if it once belonged to Mother Shipton. Do you know who Mother Shipton was?" "Of course I did. I knew that she was some old crone who was supposed to have lived in the 16th century and seen into the future, predicting, among other things, the Great Plague, the Great Fire of London, aeroplanes, battleships, and that the world would come to an end in 1881. That, like those of Nostradamus, Mother Shipton's prophecies were in doggerel verse. Fire and water shall wonders do, and all that. I also knew that there are actually still people running around loose today who believe she foresaw the use of heavy water in the making of the atomic bomb. As for myself, I didn't believe a word of it. It was nothing but a load of old tosh." "I've heard the name," I said. "Well, never mind. That's who I resemble when I'm all tarted up for the show." "Brilliant," I said, not meaning it. She could see that I was a bit put off. "What's a nice girl like you doing hanging about in a place like this?" she asked with a grin, taking in the whole of the churchyard with a wave of her hand. "I often come here to think," I said. This seemed to amuse her. She pursed her lips and put on an annoying stagey voice. "And what does Flavia Duluth think about in her quaint old country churchyard?" "Being alone," I snapped, without meaning to be intentionally rude. "I was simply being truthful." "Being alone," she said, nodding. I could see that she was not put off by my bristling reply. "There's a lot to be said for being alone, but you and I know, don't we, Flavia, that being alone and being lonely are not at all the same thing." I brightened a bit. Here was someone who seemed at least to have thought through some of the same things I had. "No," I admitted. There was a long silence. "Tell me about your family," Nia said at last, quietly. "There isn't much to tell," I said. "I have two sisters, Ophelia and Daphne. Phoebe's 17 and Daphne's 13. Phoebe plays the piano and Daphne reads. Father is a philatelist. He's devoted to his stamps." "And your mother?"
"Dead.
She was killed in an accident when I was a year old."
"Good Lord," she said. "Someone told me about a family that lived in a great rambling old mansion not far from here. An eccentric colonel and a family of girls running wild like a lot of Red Indians. You're not one of them, are you?" She saw instantly by the look on my face that I was.
"Oh, you poor child," she said. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I mean, it's quite all right," I told her. "It's far worse than that, actually, but I don't like to talk about it." I saw the faraway look come into her eyes, the look of an adult floundering desperately to find common ground with someone younger. "But what do you do with yourself?" she asked. "Don't you have any interests or hobbies?" "I'm keen on chemistry," I said, "and I enjoy making scrapbooks." "Do you really?" she enthused. "Fancy that. So did I at your age. Cigarette cards and pressed flowers, pansies, mignonettes, foxgloves, delphiniums, old buttons, valentines, poems about Granny's spinning wheel from The Girl's Own Annual. What jolly good fun it was." My own scrapbooks consisted of 3 fat purple volumes of clippings from the tide of ancient magazines and newspapers that had overflowed and then flooded the library and the drawing room at Buckshaw, spilling over into disused bedrooms and lumber rooms before being carted off at last to languish in damp, mouldering stacks in a crypt in the cellars. From their pages, I had carefully clipped everything I could find on poisons and poisoners, until my scrapbooks were bursting at the seams with the likes of Major Herbert Rouse Armstrong, the amateur gardener and solicitor who dispatched his wife with lovingly prepared concoctions of Arsenius Weed Killer, Thomas Neal Cream, Hawley Harvey Crippen, and George Chapman. Remarkable, isn't it, that so many of the great poisoners' names begin with the letter C? Who, with strychnine, hyoscine, and antimony respectively, sent a veritable army of wives and other women marching to their graves. Mary Ann Cotton, see what I mean? Who, after several successful trial runs on pigs, went on to poison 17 people with arsenic. Daisy DeMelka, the South African woman with a passion for poisoning plumbers. She would first marry them and then divorce them with a dose of strychnine. "Keeping a scrapbook is the perfect pastime for a young lady," Nia was saying, "genteel and yet educational." "My thoughts precisely." "My mum tossed mine in the dustbin when I ran away from home," she said with something that, had it lived, might have become a chuckle. "You ran away from home?" I asked. This fact intrigued me almost as much as her foxgloves, from which I recalled the vegetable alkaloid digitalin, better known to those of us who are chemists, as C36H56O14, could be extracted. I thought with pleasure for a moment of the several times in my laboratory I had exhausted with alcohol the leaves of foxglove plucked from the kitchen garden, watching the slender, shining needles as they crystallized, and the lovely emerald green solution that was formed when I dissolved them in hydrochloric acid and added water. The precipitated resin could, of course, be restored to its original green hue with sulfuric acid, turned light red by bromine vapor, and back to emerald green again with the addition of water. It was magical. It was also, of course, a deadly poison, and as such was certainly far more gripping than stupid buttons and The Girl's Own Annual. She said. "Got tired of washing up, drying up, sweeping up, and dusting up, and listening to the people next door throwing up. Tired of lying in bed at night, listening for the clatter of the prince's horse on the cobblestones." I grinned. "Rupert changed all that, of course," she said. "Come with me to the doorway of Diyarbakir," he told me. "Come to the Orient and I will make you a princess in liquid silks and diamonds the size of market cabbages."
He did?
No. What he actually said was, "My bloody assistant ran out on me. Come with me to Lyme Regis at the weekend and I'll give you a guinea, 6 square meals and a bag to sleep in. I'll teach you the art of manipulation," he said, and I was bloody fool enough to think he was talking about puppets.
Before I had time to ask for details, she had jumped to her feet and dusted off her skirt.
"Speaking of Rupert," she said, We'd better go in and see how he and the vicar are getting on.
It's ominously quiet in the parish hall. Do you suppose they might already have murdered one another?
Her flowered dress swished gracefully off among the tombstones, and I was left to trot doggedly along in her wake. Inside, we found the vicar standing in the middle of the hall. Rupert was up on the platform, centre stage, hands on hips. Had he been taking a curtain call at the old Vic, the lighting could not have been more dramatic. As if dispatched by fate, an unexpected ray of sunlight shone in through a stained glass window at the rear of the hall, fixing Rupert's upturned face dead centre in its round golden beam. He struck a pose and began spouting Shakespeare.
When my love swears that she is made of truth, I do believe her though I know she lies, that she might think me some untutored youth, unlearned in the world's false subtleties, thus vainly thinking that she thinks me young, although she knows my days are past the best. Simply, I credit her false speaking tongue. On both sides thus is simple truth suppressed.
As the vicar had mentioned, the acoustics of the hall were quite remarkable. The Victorian builders had made its interior a conch shell of curved, polished wood panelling that served as a sounding board for the faintest noise. It was like being inside a Stradivarius violin. Rupert's warm, honey-sweet voice was everywhere, wrapping us all in its rich resonance.
But wherefore, says she, not she is unjust? And wherefore say not I that I am old? O, love's best habit is in seeming trust, and age in love loves not to have years told. Therefore, I lie with her, and she with me, and in our faults by lies we flattered be. Can you hear me now, Vicar?
The spell was instantly broken. It was as if Laurence Olivier had tossed woof woof testing 1, 2, 3 into the middle of to be or not to be.
Brilliant, the Vicar exclaimed.
What surprised me most about Rupert's speech was that I knew what he was saying. Because of the nearly imperceptible pause at the end of each line and the singular way in which he illustrated the shades of meaning with his long white fingers, I understood the words, every single one of them. As if they had been sucked in through my pores by osmosis, I knew even as they swept over me that I was hearing the bitter words of an old man to a love far younger than himself. I glanced at Nia. Her hand was at her throat. In the echoing wooden silence that followed, the vicar stood stock still, as if he were carved from black and white marble. I was witnessing something that not all of us understood.
Bravo! Bravo! The vicar's cupped hands came suddenly clapping together in a series of echoing thunderbolts. Bravo! Sonnet 138, unless I'm badly mistaken. And, if I may offer up my own humble opinion, perhaps never more beautifully spoken. Rupert positively preened.
Outside, the sun went behind a cloud. Its golden beam faded in an instant, and when it had gone, we were once again just four ordinary people in a dim and dusty room.
Splendid, Rupert said. The hall will do splendidly.
He stumped across the stage and began clambering awkwardly down the narrow steps, the fingers of one hand splayed out against the wall for support.
Careful, Nia said, taking a quick step towards him. Get back, he snapped, with a look of utter ferocity. I can manage.
She stopped short in her tracks, as if he had slapped her in the face.
Nia thinks I'm her child, he laughed, trying to make a joke of it.
By her murderous look, I could see that Nia didn't think any such thing.
Chapter 3
"Well, then," the vicar said brightly, rubbing his hands together as if the moment hadn't happened. "That's settled. Where shall we begin?"
He looked eagerly from one of them to the other.
"By unloading the van, I suppose," Rupert said. "I assume we can leave things here until the show."
"Oh, of course," said the vicar. "The parish halls are safe as houses. Perhaps even a little safer."
"Then someone will need to have a look at the van, and will want a place to put up for a few days."
"Leave that department to me," the vicar said. "I'm sure I can manage something. Now then, up sleeves, and to work we go. Come along, Flavia, dear. I'm sure we'll find something suited to your special talents."
"Something suited to my special talents?"
Somehow I doubted it, unless the subject was criminal poisoning, which was my chief delight.
But still, because I didn't feel up to going home to Buckshaw just yet, I pasted on my best girl guide, retired, smile for the vicar, and followed him, along with Rupert and Nia, outside into the churchyard. As Rupert swung open the rear doors of the van, I had my first glimpse into the life of a travelling showman. The Austin's dim interior was beautifully fitted out with row upon row of varnished drawers, each one nestled snugly above, beside, and below its neighbours, very like the boxes of shoes in a well-run bootmaker's shop, with each drawer capable of sliding in and out on its own track. Piled on the floor of the van were the larger boxes, shipping crates really, with rope handles at the ends to facilitate their being pulled out and lugged to wherever they were going.
"Rupert made it all himself," Nia said proudly. "The drawers, the folding stage, the lighting equipment, made the spotlights out of old paint tins, didn't you, Rupert?"
Rupert nodded absently as he hauled away at a bundle of iron tubing.
"And that's not all. He cut the cables, made the props, painted the scenery, carved the puppets. Everything. Except that, of course."
She was pointing to a bulky black case with a leather handle and perforations in the side.
"What's in there? Is it an animal?"
Nia laughed.
"Better than that. It's Rupert's pride and joy. A magnetic recorder. Had it sent him from America. Cost him a pretty penny, I can tell you. Still, it's cheaper than hiring the BBC orchestra to play the incidental music."
Rupert had already begun to tug boxes out of the Austin, grunting as he worked. His arms were like dockyard cranes, lifting and turning, until at last nearly everything was piled in the grass.
"Allow me to lend a hand," the vicar said,
seizing a rope handle at the end of a black coffin-shaped trunk with the word Galligantus stenciled upon it in white letters, as Rupert took the other end. Nia and I went back and forth with the lighter bits and pieces, and within half an hour, everything was piled up inside the parish hall in front of the stage.
"Well done," the vicar said, dusting off the sleeves of his jacket. "Well done indeed. Now then, would Saturday be suitable? For the show, I mean. Let me see, today is Thursday. That would give you an extra day to make ready, as well as time to have your van repaired."
"Sounds all right to me," Rupert said.
Nia nodded, even though she hadn't been asked.
"Saturday it is, then. I'll have Cynthia run off handbills on the hectograph. She can take them round the shops tomorrow, slap a few up in strategic places. Cynthia's such a good sport about these things."
Of the many phrases that came to mind to describe Cynthia Richardson, good sport was not among them. Ogress, however, was. It was, after all, Cynthia, with her rodent features, who had once caught me teetering tiptoe on the altar of St. Tancred's, using one of Father's straight razors to scrape a sample of blue zaffir from a medieval stained glass window. Zaffir was an impure basic arsenate of cobalt, prepared by roasting, which the craftsmen of the Middle Ages had used for painting on glass, and I was simply dying to analyze the stuff in my laboratory to determine how successful its makers had been in the essential step of freeing it of iron. Cynthia had seized me, upended me, and spanked me on the spot, making what I thought to be unfair use of a nearby copy of Hymns Ancient and Modern, Standard Edition.
"What you have done, Flavia, is not worthy of congratulation," Father said when I reported this outrage to him. "You have ruined a perfectly good Thiers Isard hollow ground blade."
I have to admit, though, that Cynthia was a great organizer, but then so were the men with whips who got the pyramids built. Certainly, if anyone could manage to paper Bishop's Lacey from end to end in 3 days with handbills, it was Cynthia Richardson.
"Hold on," the vicar exclaimed. "I've just had the most splendid idea. Tell me what you think. Why not present 2 shows rather than one? I don't claim to be an expert in the art of the puppet theatre, by any means, knowing what is possible and what is not, and so forth. But why not put on a show Saturday afternoon for the children, and another Saturday evening, when more of the grown-ups would be free to attend?"
Rupert did not reply at once, but stood rubbing his chin. Even I could see instantly that 2 performances would double the take at the box office.
"Well," he said at last, "I suppose it would have to be the same show both times, though." "Splendid," said the vicar. "What's it to be, then? The programme, that is."
"Open with a short musical piece," Rupert said. "It's a new one I've been working up. No one's seen it yet, so this would be a good chance to try it out. Then Jack and the Beanstalk. They always clamour for Jack and the Beanstalk, young and old alike. Classic fare, very popular."
"Smashing," the vicar said.
He pulled a folded sheet of paper and the nub of a pencil from an inner pocket and scribbled a few notes.
"How's this?" he asked, with a final flourish, then, with a pleased look on his face,
read aloud what he had written.
"Direct from London. I hope you'll forgive the small fib in the exclamation point," he whispered to Nia. "Porson's Puppets, operated by the acclaimed Rupert Porson, as seen on the BBC television. Programme. 1. A musical interlude. 2. Jack and the Beanstalk, the former being presented for the first time on any stage, the latter declared to be universally popular with old and young alike. Saturday, July 22nd, 1950, at St. Tancred's Parish Hall, Bishop's Lacey. Performances at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. sharp. Otherwise, I'll just dawdle in," he added. "I'll have Cynthia dash off a sketch of a little jointed figure with strings to put at the top. She's an exceedingly talented artist, you know. Not that she's had as many opportunities as she'd like to express herself. Oh, dear, I fear I'm rambling. I'd best away to my telephonic duties." And with that he was gone. "Peculiar old duck," Rupert remarked.
"He's all right," I told him. "He leads rather a sad life."
"Ah," Rupert said, "I know what you mean. Funerals and all that."
"Yes," I said, "funerals and all that.
But I was thinking more of Cynthia."
"Which way to the mains?" Rupert asked suddenly. For a moment I was dumbfounded. I must have looked particularly unintelligent.
"The mains," he repeated, "the current, the electrical controls. But then I don't suppose you'd know where they are, would you?"
As it happened, I did. Only weeks before, I had been press-ganged into standing backstage with Mrs. Whitty, helping to throw the massive levers of the antique lighting control panel, as her first-year ballet students tripped across the boards in their recital of The Golden Apples of the Sun, in which Pomona, Deirdre Skidmore in insect netting, wooed the reluctant Hyas, a red-faced Gerald Plunkett in improvised tights cut from a pair of winter-weight long johns, by presenting him with an ever-growing assortment of papier-mâché fruit. "Stage right," I said, "behind the black tormentor curtains." Rupert blinked once or twice, shot me a barbed look, and clattered back up the narrow steps to the stage. For a few moments we could hear him muttering away to himself up there, punctuated by the metallic sounds of panels being opened and slammed and switches clicked on and off.
"Don't mind him," Nia whispered. "He's always nervous as a cat from the minute a show's booked until the final curtain falls. After that, he's generally as right as rain."
As Rupert tinkered with the electricity, Nia began unfastening several bundles of smooth wooden posts, which were bound tightly together with leather straps. "The stage," she told me, "it all fits together with bolts and butterfly nuts. Rupert designed and built it all himself. Mind your fingers." I had stepped forward to help her with some of the longer pieces. "I can do it myself, thanks," she said. "I've done it hundreds of times. Got it down to a science. Only thing that needs two to lift is the floor." A rustling sound behind me made me turn around. There stood the vicar with rather an unhappy look on his face.
"Not good news, I'm afraid," he said. "Mrs. Archer tells me that Bert has gone up to London for a training course and won't be back until tomorrow, and there's no answer at Culver House Farm, where I had hoped to put you up. But then Mrs. I doesn't often answer the telephone when she's home alone. She'll be bringing the eggs down on Saturday, but by then it will be far too late. I'd offer the vicarage, of course, but Cynthia has quite forcibly reminded me that we're in the midst of painting the guest rooms. Beds taken down and stowed in the hallways, armoires blockading the landings and so forth. Maddening, really."
"Don't fret, Vicar," Rupert said from the stage. "I nearly jumped out of my skin. I'd forgotten he was there. We'll camp where we are in the churchyard. We've a good tent in the van, with wool rugs and a rubber ground sheet, a little Primus stove, and beans in a tin for breakfast. We'll be as cozy as bugs in a blanket."
"Well," the vicar said, "if it were solely up to me, I..."
"Ah," Rupert said, raising a finger. "I know what you're thinking. Can't have gypsies camping among the graves. Respect for the dear departed and all that."
"Well," said the vicar, "there might be a modicum of truth in that, but..."
"We'll set up in an unoccupied corner, won't we? No desecration that way. Shan't be the first time we slept in a churchyard. Will it, Nia?"
Nia coloured slightly and became fascinated with something on the floor.
"Well, I suppose it's settled then," the vicar said. "We don't really have a great deal of choice, do we? Besides, it's only for one night. What harm can there be in that?"
"Oh, dear me," he said, glancing at his wristwatch. "How tempest does fugit. I gave Cynthia my solemn promise to return straight away. She's preparing an early supper, you see. We always have an early supper on Thursdays because of choir practice.
I'd invite you to join us for potluck, but..."
"Not at all," Rupert interrupted. "We've imposed enough for one day, Vicar. Besides, believe it or not, Nia's a dab hand with bacon and eggs over a churchyard bonfire. We shall eat like Corsican bandits and sleep like the dead."
Nia sat down far too gently on an unopened box, and I could see that she was suddenly exhausted. Dark circles seemed to have formed under her eyes as quickly as storm clouds blow across the moon. The vicar rubbed his chin.
"Flavia, dear," he said, "I've had the most splendid idea. Why don't you come back bright and early tomorrow morning and lend a hand? I'm sure Pawson's puppets would be most grateful to acquire the services of an eager assistant. I have home visits for the sick and shut-ins tomorrow, as well as Alter Guild," he added. "You could serve as my locum tenens, so to speak. Offer our guests the freedom of the parish, as it were, besides serving as general factotum and all-round dog's body."
"I'd be happy to," I said, making an almost imperceptible curtsy. Nia, at least, rewarded me with a smile. Outside, at the back of the churchyard, I retrieved Gladys, my trusty bicycle, from the long grass and moments later we were flying homewards through the sun-dappled lanes to Buckshaw.
Chapter 4
"Hello, all," I said to Feely's back after I had drifted inconspicuously into the drawing room. Without turning away from the mirror in front of which she was regarding herself, Feely glanced up at my reflection in the time-rippled glass.
"You're in for it this time," she said. "Father's been looking for you all afternoon. He's just got off the telephone with Constable Linnet in the village. I must say, he seemed rather disappointed to hear that they hadn't fished your soggy little corpse out of the duck pond."
"How do you know they didn't?" I countered shrewdly. "How do you know I'm not a ghost come back to haunt you into the grave?"
"Because your shoe's untied and your nose is running," Daffy said, looking up from her book.
It was Forever Amber, and she was reading it for the second time.
"What's it about?" I had asked her on the first go-round. "Flies in sap," she had said with a smug grin, and I had made a mental note to put it on my reading list. I adore books about the natural sciences.
"Aren't you going to ask me where I've been?" I said. I was simply dying to tell them about Porson's puppets and all about Nia.
"No," Feely answered, fingering the point of her chin as she leaned in for a closer look at herself. "No one is the slightest bit interested in what you do. You're like an unwanted dog."
"I'm not unwanted," I said.
"Oh, yes, you are," she said with a hard laugh. "Name one person in this household who wants you and I'll give you a guinea. Go ahead, name one."
"Harriet," I said. "Harriet wanted me, or she wouldn't have had me."
Feely whirled round and spat on the floor. She actually spat. "For your information, Spot, Harriet fell into a profound mental bog immediately after you were born."
"Ha," I said. "I've got you there. You told me I was adopted."
It was true. Whenever Daffy or Feely wanted to aggravate me beyond endurance, they would renew that claim. "And so you were," she said. "Father and Harriet made an agreement to adopt you even before you were born. But when the time came and your natural mother delivered you, you were given out by mistake to someone else. A couple in East Kent, I believe. Unfortunately, they returned you." It was said to be the first time in the 200-year history of the Foundling Hospital that anyone had returned a baby because they didn't like it. Harriet didn't care for you either once she got you home, but the papers were already signed and the Board of Governors refused to take you back a second time. I'll never forget the day I overheard Harriet telling Father in her dressing room that she could never love such a rat-faced muling. But what could she do? Well, she did what any normal woman would do in those circumstances. She fell into a deeply troubled state, and one from which she probably never recovered. She was still in the grip of it when she fell. Or was it jumped? Off that mountain in Tibet. Father has always blamed you for it. Surely you must realize that." The room went cold as ice, and suddenly I was numb from head to toe. I opened my mouth to say something, but found that my tongue had dried up and shriveled to a curled-up flap of leather. Hot tears welled up in my eyes as I fled the room. "I'd show that bloody swine Feely a thing or two. I'd have her so tied up in knots they'd have to hire a sailor to undo her for the funeral." There is a tree that grows in Brazil, Carica digitata, which the natives call Camburu. They believe it to be such deadly poison that simply sleeping beneath its branches will cause, first of all, ever-festering sores, followed sooner or later by a wonderfully excruciating death. Fortunately for Feely, though, Carica digitata does not grow in England. Fortunately for me, fool's parsley, better known as poison hemlock, does. In fact, I knew a low and marshy corner of Seaton's Meadow, not 10 minutes from Buckshaw, where it was growing at that very moment.
I could be there and back before supper. I'd recently updated my notes on conine, the active principle of the stuff. I would extract it by distilling with whatever alkali was handy, perhaps a bit of the sodium bicarbonate I kept on hand in my laboratory against Mrs. Mullet's culinary excesses. I would then, by freezing, remove by recrystallization the iridescent scales of the less powerful conhydrin. The resulting nearly pure conine would have a deliciously mousy odor, and it would take less than half a drop of the oily stuff to put paid to old accounts. Agitation, vomiting, convulsions, frothing at the mouth, horrendous spasms. I ticked off the highlights on my fingers as I went.